This is James McElhenney. I first met Don Stinson when I moved to Colorado nearly 20 years ago. I felt an immediate affinity with what he was doing. Stinson's focus was on landscape, not as scenery nor as an artistic trope, but as a dialogue between terrain and the society which shapes and consumes it. Mindful of history, Western exploration, and influenced by the writings of J.B. Jackson, Stinson's paintings take notice of dystopic anomalies, industrial intrusions, and modern ruins. Adrift in vast deserts or located near majestic geological formations, these byproducts of disposable culture are at once elegiac and cautionary. What lies between? New works by Don Stinson is now on view at David B. Smith Gallery in Denver, Colorado. We caught up with each other recently to talk about the exhibition. Hi, Don. How are you today?
I'm good, Jim.
Well, tell me about the show, What Lies Between. Looks terrific online. I've seen a dozen images. All the paintings that we looked at together in your studio a couple of weeks ago, I imagine they look wonderful in the gallery.
Yes, it's really great to get them up and installed. I designed that show for the space of the gallery down at David B. Smith, so I'm really happy to be able to realize that vision.
Now, I think anybody that comes to the show is going to know immediately that you're pursuing a different kind of narrative than the canonical Western landscape, although it's pretty obvious that you're influenced by people like Albert Bierstadt and Thomas Moran. But there is a hint of irony, too, or there is a hint of evidence of a sort of a post-industrial, almost a dystopic condition that affects the Western landscape.
You know, the dystopic vision, I think, is very interesting. You know, with those images of Bierstadt and Moran, if they've been so influential in terms of, you know, even commercial photography, but just everything, the way we perceive wilderness, the way we perceive the landscape in general. And I guess what people don't realize is that there was a separation that happened when Moran left the train out, when he got off at Green River, Wyoming. We kind of started separating wilderness from industry. And I think that was useful and wonderful. That vision gave us all these great national parks and wild lands, which are very important. But I see the issue now as kind of a reintegration. How do we successfully live with these wild places and maintain them and develop other uses? And picturing that is the challenge. And what I hope to be doing is saying, yeah, this is a great thing to be working on. And it's exciting and wonderful to look at a successful landscape that integrates all different uses.
I'm not seeing that image here on the gallery website, that being, you know, the bridge across the Green River, railroad bridge, that would have been used by Moran when he arrived there. I mean, a lot of people have a look at those paintings of his, and they think that he arrived there on the back of a mule or something, or in a wagon, and that this just loomed up out of nowhere. But in fact, he got there on the railroad. Isn't that true?
Yeah, he arrived on the railroad. They were constructing the bridge, and one of his traveling companions, the photographer Jackson, you know, took some great photographs of the second railroad bridge. It wasn't even the first being built when Moran arrived. Part of that was the railroad was selling the West. You know, you need to have people wanting to go to the West.
Yeah, that was one of Joni Kinsey's arguments, as I recall, from, you know, her book on Bierstadt, was that those areas of the West that were not deemed to be profitable for mineral resources became the tourist attractions, places like the Grand Canyon and Yellowstone, which were absolutely bereft of gold or silver or iron or anything else that could be extracted from
tillable, tillable soil.
Right, or tillable soil, right.
Yeah, these great wonders, it's hard for us to even perceive that the Grand Canyon was thought of as an abyss, a horror, and that art slowly transformed that from a horror to a wonder.
Well, it was an impediment. Certainly, you couldn't cross it easily. And the river, while it was navigable, I guess technically, was also very, very perilous and not the kind of a waterway that you would choose, you know, for the movement of goods. So it was pretty useless until it became a wonder of nature.
You know, so for me, painting now, I think it's kind of the new frontier is making these in between what lies between, you know, nature and man, these spaces we think of as wastelands today, making them compelling somehow or just looking at them, you know, in the kind of open-minded investigation. What's possible? How do we visualize compelling future places?
Well, I think that's part of the history of American landscape, isn't it? That it's undergoing constant revision and redefinition. Stephen H. Long's expedition, which happened nearly 200 years ago, ended with him declaring that, you know, the plains were you know, the great American desert, and it couldn't be further from the truth. It became, you know, the breadbasket of the country in the years that followed. So this whole misapprehension of what the West is the history of the West in a way. And I see your work as exploring that in many, many ways. I remember one of the first pieces I saw of yours in the Denver Art Museum was of a ruined drive-in theater. And you had, as part of the installation, you had actually one of those sound boxes on a mast that you would hang on, you know, the window of your car in order to listen to the film being shown on the screen. What was the genesis of that for you? I mean, at what point did you start really becoming aware of the landscape as a narrative beyond scenery, beyond the spectacle of nature?
You know, I was a figure painter for a long time, and I lived in Boston and then Seattle. And when coming back to Colorado was a coming home, and I just was kind of seeing it fresh, like often happens on a return home, with new eyes, and had a lot of questions about how people live, how people create culture, you know, in the center, you know, in the Rockies. For a while, I thought culture was replaced by a sort of intimate relationship with the mountain landscape through climbing and skiing. But then I realized, no, this is just developing. There's a really, really active culture that has just not stayed, that's been often transitory. And then I started looking for the roots of what had kind of clung to the spine of the country, you know, that Rocky Mountain spine that goes from Montana down into New Mexico. And so this just led to that, the inquiry of what makes culture here. And then I realized that a lot of mythic American culture, manifest destiny, you know, kind of reshaping the map. You know, it happened here. It was inspired by getting to these mountains. Gosh, I'll never forget going with my wife to the American Museum of Art in D.C., and they had all those great Morans, the two Yellowstone Fall pictures and the Grand Canyon. And the Grand Canyon, the Yellowstone, and then the Grand Canyon paintings, and they were right at floor level. And I realized, wow, this is just an overwhelming marriage of public policy and painting. And maybe there's a way to do this now. That was probably 1991, 92. Mm-hmm. And that really started me thinking of where were the places, you know, and they tend to be quiet, overlooked places, in between places where policy is changing the landscape. Unexpectedly, it was gas stations. There were all these abandoned gas stations. And I think what had happened was a policy about the underground storage tanks required their removal, which was just too much for some of these little businesses. And the franchise weren't supporting replacing them. So they just pulled up stakes, left it there, and didn't, you know, that that $40,000 to replace that tank or whatever it was just took them under. So here, a public policy had unintentionally just left the landscape marked with these relics of a thriving, you know, retail point of the oil industry. And then that led to the next one was like, okay, there's this revolution in information technology and all these empty drive-in screens. And to me, they just looked like the perfect juncture of the industrial age and the information age. You know, right when information went broadcast, right when information started going digital, these relics of the mechanical version just were left standing.
A lot of your images seem to address this issue of car culture and the American addiction to mobility. And as we're saying earlier, a lot of these places like the Grand Canyon and Yellowstone were developed as tourist attractions by, you know, the Fred Harvey Company and you know, the Santa Fe Railroad and, you know, real campaign to try to move people from, you know, the cities in the East or elsewhere out to these wild places, supposedly wild places that were heavily interpreted and heavily marketed. But as they passed across the landscape in either a train or an automobile, you know, they would have to stop along the way. And a lot of what you seem to be interested in painting, like Eat Death Highway 395, where you've done two paintings. Well, there's Eat Taxes, so that's kind of funny. Death and taxes.
Yeah.
And for the listener, the two paintings that are similar in size, not identical, but they portray the high desert with a sign to a now not even abandoned. It's just a disappeared eatery of some sort, a diner. And the sign is seen from two different points of view off of a dirt road, which is off of a major highway. And what's interesting about these two is that at least in one of them, the Eat Taxes Highway painting, the sky is crisscrossed by jet vapor trails. So that again speaks to the presence of transportation. And that is a narrative of mobility.
Yes.
As we're having a look at your work, I mean, what are you hoping people are going to take away? Because, you know, scenery is an awfully strong assumption that people, when they have a look out the window or they have a look out the window of a car, they're looking at a postcard or they're out on a hike, you know, they take a look around and what they see is scenery. But in fact, it's not, as you and I think, agree that it's a narrative and that what you're doing is excavating that narrative in a way. I wonder if you could unfold that a little bit more for us.
I think that's absolutely true. I think, I mean, you're battling a giant kind of marketing machine in terms of the tourist industry selling a kind of canned experience. I know we're both fans of John Brinkerhoff Jackson and his work. And he used to talk a lot about, you know, the great cultural geographer, John J.B. Jackson. Mm-hmm. And I think he used to talk a lot about what's missing from these marketing pictures, what's missing from these plans to build, you know, the new shopping center or the building downtown, or now it's all the apartment complexes. What's always missing in those promotional images are the workers. Where's the work? And because people don't want to go on vacation and think about work, it's just missing from our visual language. What I'm really looking at is evidence of a work. And you're right to point out transportation in terms of the West. That's been building the railroad. It was the essential work that happened after, you know, after the settlements started to arrive. I mean, maybe that happened at the same time. And then the highway and post-World War II, the interstate, and it just, that became the public space, that became the places. And now we're in this transition, like the, I like to call it the transition from drive-by to flyover, where, you know, people are traveling just from city to city and missing this what lies between. So in a way, that's the theme of the show, is what lies between and what are we leaving behind? What is going to come back and bite us if we neglect it? You know, it's the working landscape.
Well, the landscape is a work in progress, but as J.B. Jackson said, landscapes do not occur in nature. They are created when people adapt terrain to their use. So in other words, what we're looking at, is not what's there, but what we desire.
Yeah, that's right.
Or fear.
That's right. And or fear, and if it's being laced with these underground gas flow pipes, what's the impact of that? What's going to happen? If it's being kind of flown over and you know, to the point where the contrails are creating a new kind of atmosphere, a new kind of cloud canopy, just where does that lead us? I mean, it's just kind of think we can't afford not to look. We need to kind of see that impact. Is it acceptable? Is there something beautiful happening, beautiful and new, a change that we can embrace? Or does it need to be tweaked a little bit as we go?
Well, I think it's interesting, too, to note that some of your pictures, All in Good Time, the two pictures with that title, portray wind farms. And if I'm not mistaken, they look like the wind farms below Joshua Tree, California, outside of Palm Springs. Is that right?
Yes, I have Palm Springs. I've also painted the ones along the Caprock in the Panhandle of Texas. This sort of ultimate wind turbine is very sleek and beautiful and elegant. I think early versions, and that's one of the things that attracted me to the Palm Springs area, they really have the whole history, including the kind of small, fast-moving ones that look like they were on oil derricks.
Right.
And so you can really track that evolution, and there's something really elegant and compelling about these giant wind turbines. At the same time, you know, even green energy, a positive solution in many ways, on a vast industrial scale can be a bit disconcerting. And, you know, we have some choices to make. We have some policy issues. So visualizing and making it clear what that looks like and what the impacts might be, I think that's one of those really interesting junctures. You know, we're reshaping the landscape and we're making these decisions without really understanding the way it's going to change our lives. And just to try to make it as visible as possible, it's a little bit heartbreaking, some of these changes. You know, it's like when your kids grow up and go off to college, it's like, okay, it's wonderful you're there, but it's also very sad. And I'm not sure about the wind turbines. I sometimes think, wow, this is great that we can power all this. Other times, I'm really miss that open horizon line.
Well, yeah, there is a kind of hint of endless possibilities just over the next range of mountains, you know, in this mythic story of westward migration and the pioneers sort of straining to get to some homestead where they're going to become, you know, successful and happy and like live a, you know, the American dream. But then there are also paintings in the show like Cadillac Ranch. A lot of people know Cadillac Ranch is of course a kind of absurdist monument with a number of Cadillacs, 8 or 9 Cadillacs, nose down into the ground, angling upward like a kind of Stonehenge arrangement of ceremonial objects. It's fairly well known. I think it was a cult destination even, you know, 30, 40 years
ago. When it was made, yeah.
Right. Yeah. So it was a sort of purpose-made, absurdist tourist attraction, you know, kind of like, I forget the name of the ranch in like western Kansas where they got the, you know, the two-headed chicken and 100 rattlesnakes.
Right.
But these, again, were like roadside attractions.
Yeah. You know, I think what's interesting about Cadillac Ranch is that it really is an art piece and a commentary on American culture, the sort of history of the tail fin, and they're all put in at that angle, you know, at a kind of tail fin angle, while the idea of making these cars along the highway is kind of perfect in a way. It, to me, it also relates to Smith and Spiral Jetty and and Heiser's double negative that I've also painted as these kind of monumental earthworks. I thought Cadillac Ranch was pretty interesting in that they decided not to ignore the highway culture, you know, ant farm, decided not to ignore highway culture, but to really integrate it into their art. And in a way, as a Westerner, I always like it when people engage the culture that's here. There's a quality of Spiral Jetty and even Double Negative. It's a little bit like the West is a blank slate where we can do what we want. That's not really true. I guess I both of them acknowledge really ancient cultures, you know, with the spiral and those. I think Heiser was acknowledging some wall paintings in those canyons around that site. But it's really interesting the degree to which ant farm embrace highway culture. So I think that kind of separates it, that association with the land art separates it from things like the Big Chicken and the dinosaurs that, you know, the roadside attractions, and kind of elevates it to something different. I mean, but it's still so popular a stop. It's a compelling marriage of high and low culture too, where they allow people to go out there and spray paint it and put graffiti on that. I mean, that's just an amazing thing. That would be a desecration. Yeah, that'd be a desecration at Double Negative.
Of course, because it's a different formal language. The intention was different, you know. But you know, it's a sort of serious work of art that is to be preserved according to the wishes of the artist, whereas what you're saying with Cadillac Ranch, it was erected with the intention of accepting interventions by random tourists and vandals and others, that was just part of the process.
Yeah.
So does that become like a metaphor for outcroppings of rock, which are, you know, covered with graffiti and Bob Love Sue and all that?
I think it feels that way. I think people have a visceral reaction to that graffiti, like it's been desecrated sometime. But I think when it's cars that are meant to, that are sort of reintegrated with the ground, kind of nose down in the dirt, in a way it's saying it's a very blunt kind of marriage of land and industrial culture. And then when you spray paint it, it's saying, yeah, but it's still alive. Look, you can still participate in this. You still are participating in it. And the only question is, do you like it? And everybody seems to like spray painting on it. They may not like, you know, I mean, it's compelling.
It's landscape painting.
It's landscape painting. I think one of the things I like about all the land art is it, you know, it just acknowledges that this has always been, you mentioned this earlier, Jim, that landscapes happen when we alter them, that it's right. Always a construction. And when we decide to make a park or when we decide to leave something wild, it's not because it's pure, it's because we like it that way. You know, we want to see what it would be with minimal intervention. But it's still a choice that we're making. I love the way art points to these choices.
Well, you were talking earlier about how the marketplace conventionally doesn't want, you know, cars. It doesn't want billboards. It doesn't want motels or highway strips. It doesn't want blacktop. It wants some kind of pristine view of the natural terrain without human intervention. That seems to be sort of the conventional taste, if you will. What you're saying in your work is that it's all intervention. You know, if you cast your gaze upon a portion of the terrain, you know, you're creating a landscape by that action. It's not there. The tree doesn't care the cloud doesn't care, the terrain could care less if you're there, or how you value it. And yet we, you know, we carry out all sorts of things on the terrain. We do strip mining, we build highways, we erect kitsch architecture, and we put automobiles nose down in the ground. Human intervention is what makes the landscape.
Yeah. And then it's just about kind of critiquing our judgment and
right.
and making it possible to make better choices. And it's not always obvious. I mean, these are very complex issues about how you live on the land and with each other on the land. So, and it's curious to me that landscape painting among, you know, in the realm of art is such a traditional kind of genre when most of what's really compelling and interesting in the world is happening within landscapes, you know, how they're changing, how cities are changing, you know, even institutions are changed by our approach to dividing space. This is something that's, I hope, changes over time, where this kind of investigation of space is really seen as more on the front edge of things.
It seems a lot of people are turning inward more and more with their handheld devices, with their computers, with excursions into virtual reality, and that perhaps a certain amount of negligence is a result of that, in terms of negligence regarding stewardship of the terrain and natural resources. And of course, there's the discussion about global warming. And obviously, your use of, you know, wind turbines hints at the fact that you might be suggesting there are other ways to generate energy other than those that might create carbon emissions.
Well, how to visualize carbon emissions is really, because, you know, it's sort of happened invisibly, and if you can't see it, people don't believe it. So I actually did a series of drawings of these gas pumps floating up into the sky, trying to make this a reality to people, but I'm not sure. I mean, it was made for beautiful drawings.
Right.
Yeah.
I like saw Mike those
Lynch's horses
hanging from chains in your studio. You had some old gas pumps hanging from chains in your Evergreen,
yes,
Colorado studio. Yeah, I think also the presence of the jet trails is another clue. And the skyscape has really changed in the post-industrial era. And I think people who want to take time to read what those changes are and how they're expressed in your work might be able to draw some interesting conclusions. Yeah, I think maybe the thing to explore is also what people's assumptions are about landscape painting. And for instance, I know that you and I have had a lot of conversations about this, about realism as a style. And I think we agree it's pretty much, that's kind of a secondary issue here.
Yes. I mean, for me, I'm just trying to use the most direct tools that have kind of the largest and longest in terms of history reach. Well, it's really investigating and inquiring about the spaces that we live in. I think photography has been incredibly powerfully influential. You were talking about devices. I think once people started touching their phones to interact with them, it started to get really interesting in terms of their engagement with the spaces around them. I'm kind of watching that as a development, and just the ubiquity of images, so that when you make a painting, you're actually performing a kind of curatorial job. You're saying, okay, I'm going to integrate this kind of pan, which now, because of the panorama mode on everybody's phone, they can now understand that this space wraps around you. Whereas that used to be kind of hard to move people to understand a space that is behind you and in front of you at the same time. Now you can really use that language. So I can borrow from the language of the phone. I can borrow from the language of a Robert Adams from the 60s and that modern formalism. And I can borrow from, you know, some of the romance and the power of a Bierstadt or a Moran and say, have you thought about the impact of this little device? This is almost as game-changing as the railroad, you know? And, you know, you give it that, Mount of the Holy Cross change in the atmosphere, mm-hmm. which is also a kind of reality since the atmosphere is changing. I mean, I try to have these skies always be an active player and say, this is not a backdrop. This is not neutral. You know, it has to be dealt with. And just making a kind of image that is inclusive, that brings all these bits into play. And even in doing that, you know, if you just manage to make a good painting out of that, you're saying, is it possible for us to successfully navigate this terrain of the future?
You alluded to the Mount of the Holy Cross. That's actually changed too, that the arm of the cross has collapsed. So it no longer looks the way it did when it was painted by Moran.
Right. It collapsed. And of course, it doesn't hold a snowfield like it used to because we don't have as much ice up there.
Correct.
You know, it's warmer.
Well, your paintings, too, might invite some comparison to other artists like Rackstraw Downs comes to mind, who divides his time between New York City and Presidio, Texas. He was one of the notable painters, I think, of the last half century, whose landscapes the viewer has to actually turn their head in order to read the painting. And I think that could also characterize your work, too, that you're inviting the viewer to turn their head to approach the picture in a variety of ways, especially a picture like Highway 103 or High Desert Contemporary, which are long horizontal panoramic views. And then another painting that you did that I'd love to hear you unpack a little for us, Near Nukla, which is very long, very, very, almost a 360 degree. I expect it's more like 180 or perhaps more. 180 degree panorama. What was the genesis of that picture?
Well, I want to talk about Rackstraw Downs, I think Woody Gwynn,
right.
Chuck Horstman, and Richard Estes are really a generation that kind of opened up the possibility of representation and imagery from the landscape. There was a lot of interesting photorealism going on, but Richard Estes was really interesting because of the way he developed these composite images, mm-hmm. you know, where it was just a layer of multiple photographs. And, you know, you came to understand that as the depth of an image, you know, the complexity of an image that you could build from all these different photographs. I mean, that exploration was very interesting. I think a lot of us kind of stand on that possibility. There were other people combining. I mean, even David Hockney, the way he combined the multiple points of view and to make one image with the Polaroids. You know, that's kind of one tradition that I think was really important. And then Rackstraw Downs and, you know, a few of the other sort of direct observation, kind of painterly touch people. Fairfield Porter, I think, was sort of as a nice counterpoint to Rackstraw Downs, where he is really, in a way, juxtaposing his touch and a very personal vision of from within life. You know, they're kind of just all melding in this sort of gooey, delicious paint. And then you have Rackstraw Downs doing this very kind of almost experiential, mapped out, opening up the space sort of almost surgically in my mind. And those processes are just incredibly useful. So when I was talking about really engaging multiple points of view, what those painters did was say, I can draw, you know, they kind of established the idea that I can draw on all these traditions and the photographers, you know, And I can look at the new topographer generation and understand they're really exploring a side of the culture that painters are not. One of the things I like about Rackshaw Downs is he really carries on that explorer artist tradition, that great British tradition where he's like here and he's going, wow, look at what they're doing with border stations around Presidio. Wow, look at what's happened to Marfa. I like that kind of inquisition of the landscape that's going on.
He insists on being present and being actually on the motif and relying not so much on secondary information like photographs. He actually prefers right. to be on site. And yeah, I think the comparison with expeditionary artists is apt, a long history that I think has been neglected. Certainly a number of the artists of whom you spoke, like Woody Gwynn, Chuck Forsman, I'd also include Keith Jacobshagen in that. You know his
yes,
work.
Yeah.
And I think this is an impulse that I think has found more traction in the West for some reason. And because, I mean, it's attracted these artists to that part of the country. Perhaps the landscape's there.
Those painters, I think, are important. I think what's happened now is that this flow of images from the phones and other devices, the landscapes that people are experiencing, the virtual reality of, let's say, video games, are so influential that it's important to engage them. So for me, it's important to understand the culture of photography. It's important to understand the culture of a video game landscape and to really bring a synthesis of that when I'm asking these questions about the actual spaces around me. So I don't find it useful to leave photography out anymore. I think I'm glad that's working there. I think it's important what Rackshaw Downs has done, but a kind of like when Moran separated technology from the wilderness, I think it's important to reintegrate. You know, we're living with the highway, we're living with the plains, we're living with virtual reality and photographic images. And the truth is, the tradition of landscape painting is strong enough and is a vehicle capable of absorbing these influences. And it's just a very important critical tool. And why would you leave these elements that are shifting people's perceptions so radically out? I'll never forget the first trip I took my son, the first time I took my son to L.A., and I realized he completely understands this landscape without never being here. He knows what to expect based on a video game he's been playing that's set in a kind of pseudo L.A., this is how he's learning, and it's incredibly effective how to navigate space. You know, then you realize that this is the way we're going to conduct wars through drones and remote control. Wow. I mean, I just feel like it's imperative to try to keep up and integrate these concepts of landscape.
Underlying all of this, though, there seems to be a message of society needing to take greater responsibility for the well-being of the environment and the terrain, even you know, visual culture of the terrain. And these, I think the message of eat your painting, eat death highway, eat taxes highway, not so much Cadillac Ranch, but maybe Wyoming Home and others, is you've got these kitschy ruins in the landscape that, I mean, you know, the moral is that this kind of stuff can't possibly survive for long. You know, if you build a Mickey D's in the middle of the desert, you know, in another 20 years, it's going to be a ruin. It'll be just a denizen for the jackrabbits and Gila monsters.
Yeah, if it's going to be a kind of temporary disposable culture, then we want to build in a way that those things can be recycled or redeemed responsibly. And, you know, this power to redeem what seems horribly irredeemable is it's always surprising to me. An example of this would be Martha, Texas, where you go down and because it's become a kind of art mecca, every little space is being creatively re-inhabited. And these stories, I think, are part of what I'm trying to tell, that those eat deaf spaces, it's kind of about hubris. It's about understanding that what's absolutely necessary for one generation may not be necessary for the next, and try to move through life in a sort of caring, gentle way. I mean, I like the wilderness ethic where it's kind of leave no trace, which is not possible, but I feel like that could be starting to have an influence where we're going to build all these wind turbines, but we're not pretending that they're perfect. We're not pretending that they're going to last forever. They're already being recycled in Norway and Sweden. So maybe that's great. Maybe all the plastic we've been throwing away can be made into these wind turbines and then reused. What is the long view? If it's all temporary, then maybe that needs to be the design.
That's a great idea. Well, the wind turbines, too, the question that's often raised is, what is the carbon footprint created by the production of one of these machines versus the amount of energy they're able to produce? That it's clean energy, but it doesn't, they're not created by clean energy. You know, the plastics are not, and the industrial components are not necessarily created by clean energy, even though they're creating electricity without burning fossil fuels. So there's
right.
there are those questions. And then there's also a kind of ironic or almost humorous aspect to a painting like Eat Death Highway, where there's a sign hovering in the sky that says eat. And, you know, we're looking at the terrain, and is it inviting us to consume that as well?
Right.
And it's a little
is
sort
consumer
of
cultural, is consumer culture sustainable? Are we really going to be able to keep this up? And there's evidence in the landscape that maybe not.
Yeah, we may all be temporary as we are.
Yeah. Yeah.
The works of man. Just to return to J.B. Jackson for a minute, he wrote a wonderful essay called The Necessity of Ruins, which he, you know, explores the whole, you know, elegiac role played by former buildings and other, you know, other traces of, right. of you know, human activity in the palimpsest of the landscape.
Well, and his model has been very influential, this idea of a golden age, and then it falls into disrepair, and that's kind of the culture and a pause, and then somebody figures out how to revive it, and that's the redemption, and then has another golden age. And that's basically, you know, a kind of Christian cycle, I guess, you know, or influenced by that cycle. When I painted Eat, Death, Taxes, I was thinking of, okay, what's this Buddhist idea of a bardo, this kind of Tibetan Buddhist idea of a pause between lives. What if we're all coming back? You know, maybe that's the thing. Maybe that's the belief system that'll help us, you know, leave things in a better place. Because when you come back, you want to come back to something good. And kind of the joke of that painting for me, which is really serious, is, well, are you going to be happy coming back to the abandoned eat sign? Is that going to be enough? Or do you want to leave it, you know, completely empty? Is a wild place what right. you would come back to? Or are there improvements that you would want to live it with in your next life? These belief systems become a way to explore higher possibilities in the present. You know, what can we do now that makes things better?
So what's your hope that a viewer is going to take away from your show at the David B. Smith Gallery?
My sort of base hope is that people see things that they weren't seeing before. They see possibility where they only saw ruin. They see a hope for improvement where they would have just walked away. That's been, you know, an underlying hope in my work for a long time. But right now, and the reason I titled the show What Lies Between is I want the middle ground. I want the compromise places. I want an understanding that those are where hope lies. This kind of old trope, if everybody's a little unhappy, you probably have a good agreement. Well, I think there's something to that. When you look at the landscape, if you see it performing multiple uses for multiple parties, it's not necessarily ruined. It may be doing a really good job. It may be a good design. And if you can see what's good about that design, then you can improve it. So I'm hoping to draw attention to some of these places where compromises are being made, effective compromises are being made, or where they might be seen, might be understood.
Well, thank you for your time, Don. It's great. It's great catching up with you. Work looks wonderful. I felt very privileged to have a chance to have seen it all in your studio before it went off to the gallery, and I wish you a lot of success with this body of work.
Well, thanks so much, Jim. And I tell you, it was great to share it with you and get your eye and your understanding of the landscape, which I've always enjoyed sharing with you.
Well, the conversation will continue. Thanks again,
thanks,
Don.
Jim. Goodbye.
What Lies Between. New works by Don Stinson will be on view through June 3rd at David B. Smith Gallery, 1543 A, Wazee Street, Denver, Colorado, 80202. Gallery hours are Wednesday to Friday, noon to 6 p.m., and Saturday, noon to 5 p.m., and by appointment. For more information, please go to the gallery website at www.davidbsmithgallery.com. Learn more about Don Stinson and his work at www.donstinson.com. This is James McElhenney. Thanks for listening.